This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehius Wulheep in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We are definitely worried that this is now going to, break out into, again, the same type of xenophobic violence that we've seen over and over.
That was Amnesty International South Africa Director Shanila Mohammed on the rising anti-foreigner trend in the country. Details coming up. Also, the U.S. is unlocking billions of dollars of investment across Africa. And the Ethiopian government deploys troops to the Tigrayan region, accusing it of attacking federal troops. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The United States is unlocking billions of dollars of investment across Africa. A senior U.S. government representative said Washington is doubling down on its commitment to a two-way trade and investment partnership. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
Speaking to reporters recently, Victoria Whitney, chief operating officer for the U.S. government's Prosper Africa Initiative, revealed that the effort was not only supporting trade and investment flows from Africa to the United States, but also from the U.S. to Africa.
Today, to be able to say that Prosper's approach is delivering some really significant impact. Over the past year, directly supporting more than 280 deals to close across more than 30 African countries for a total value of over $22 billion. And many of those deals included support to small and medium-sized African businesses, paying extra close attention to those SMEs.
Created in 2018, Prosper Africa Initiative has put additional focus on facilitating bilateral investment and trade. The U.S. is home to the world's capital pools. Whitney says greater U.S. investment in Africa and greater economic engagement between the two regions will drive economic growth and foster shared prosperity for their people.
If just 1% of U.S. pension funds were invested in Africa, that alone would be over $120 billion. And that's why Prosper Africa has been working so closely with pension funds and other institutional investors to build up that multi-billion dollar pipeline. And in fact, we're close to closing $1 billion in U.S. institutional investment in Africa in early 2021.
Some impediments remain, as the senior American official explains.
Honestly, a core challenge remains that some U.S. companies aren't seeking out opportunities in Africa because of perceived risk. We want to take on some of that burden, addressing that perceived risk, raising awareness about the African markets of today with U.S. businesses and investors. We want to show that the U.S. government is prioritizing trade and investment with Africa. The incredible U.S.-Africa Investment Conference held just a few weeks ago is a tremendous reflection of that.
With some of the world's fastest growing economies, Africa will have 100 cities with more than 1 million inhabitants by the year 2025, according to official estimates. This urbanization boom, experts say, will drive investment and unlock new opportunities for U.S. businesses, from construction and transportation to smart city infrastructure and innovations in agriculture. Some say the U.S. is coming in a little too late when there is a question about China taking the lion's share of the large-scale projects in most African countries. Whitney weighed in on the issue.
It's been said that in some ways it's not a competition. We're not playing the same games. And I reference that 1% of U.S. pension funds coming in at over $120 billion. Well, that's more than double China's so-called commitment to the continent. And that's with no strings attached, but also a commitment to local job creation and deeply held values in support of economic freedom, sovereignty, and individual rights. That is not the approach of our competitor.
Through the United States-backed initiative, a Nigerian-based healthcare technology company completed a $3.6 million investment thanks to transaction advisory support from the U.S. government. There are more examples. In Djibouti, the first U.S. infrastructure project built by the U.S. private sector is underway. Nebraska-based firm CR Energy Concepts is building a $190 million U.S. dollar renewable energy park in the Horn of African nation. U.S. officials say 90% of the equipment in the plant will be U.S.-made. The park will support Djibouti in the power grid and create more than 100 local jobs. For VOA News, this is Ruben Chama in Nairobi.
Reuters reported that Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed ordered the military to deploy to the Tigray region today after accusing the regional government of attacking federal troops, a major escalation of a row between the premier and the once-powerful region. In September, Tigray held regional elections in defiance of the federal government, which called the vote illegal. The row has escalated in recent days, with both sides accusing each other of plotting a military conflict. Abiy's office said in a statement that the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, attempted to steal artillery and other equipment from federal forces stationed there today. The statement claimed that the federal government is therefore forced into a military confrontation. Rival Libya officers are discussing the mechanics of implementing a ceasefire agreement that was reached October 23rd. The Joint Military Commission is holding a three-day meeting on Libyan soil. There was no mention of inviting UN or EU observers to monitor the ceasefire, and there was discussion about Libyan security forces taking care of the disputed line in Sirte. Wolfgang Porstai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi what could make or break the military talks and how they could pave the way for a political solution.
The signing of the ceasefire is certainly a very important success, actually a key success. But unfortunately, and the text is not very precise. Almost everything other than a permanent and countrywide ceasefire, which is immediately in force, is unclear. Among these many open issues are, how will the ceasefire itself be monitored? Who are the mercenaries and foreign fighters who are to depart from Libya within a period of 3 months? What does this mean for the Russian fighter jets? Does this include the Turks, although they are invited by the internationally recognized government? Where is the concrete location of the demilitarized zone, if there is one? What does this mean for Al-Jufra and its airbase? What kind of foreign military training inside Libya must be suspended? Does this include the training provided by Turkey and Qatar? What does this mean for the Coast Guard training, which is at times provided by the European Union? So there are many, many open issues. But nevertheless, let me stress again, alone that there is a ceasefire, that there are signatures under the ceasefire agreement, is already a major step forward.
There was no mention of inviting UN or European Union observers to monitor the ceasefire, and there was a talk about Libyan security forces to take care of the disputed line in Sirte. Would that work?
Unfortunately, the Libyans are extremely hesitant to invite a foreign monitoring for various reasons. There is a general aversion in Libya against foreign boots on the ground, other than foreign boots which are directly supporting one's own case. And for the more hawkish people on both sides, it's quite clear that such a monitoring would make it extremely difficult for them to continue hostilities in the future. And for these and other reasons, they are right now not talking about this. Right now, they are discussing only about locally recruited police force for Sirte. And such locally recruited, lightly armed police force is maybe sufficient to guarantee the local security, also for a government which is eventually located in Sirte. But certainly this would not be enough to deter any kind of military aggression. This means Sirte would become a military vacuum, which is quite dangerous. If the LNA would hand over Sirte to such a police force, they would certainly stay close to the city and would be able to return immediately. On the other side, also Operation Volcano could try to make a surprise attack to occupy the city. So if just a local police force is monitoring Sirte and more or less the ceasefire, this would not be a real guarantee that the ceasefire will hold.
Stephanie Williams, the UN acting envoy, said a lot of progress was made and the courage and determination between those officers is what is needed for Libyan political class. What do you make of such a statement?
Actually, Stephanie Williams is very enthusiastic about the progress made in Ghadames during all these talks. And this is also understandable, keeping in mind that her tour is about to end. there is certainly a progress that they are meeting now for the military talks in Ghadames, in Libya, for direct talks. There is a progress in the talks. Mainly, they have agreed on a roadmap for implementing the ceasefire, but it's not clear what exactly will be implemented. They have agreed to establish a military subcommittee to oversee the withdrawal of military forces to their respective bases and the departure of foreign forces from the front lines. I am not aware that Turks or Russians are right now directly deployed at the front lines. They have agreed that the Joint Military Commission, which is established by the ceasefire agreement, will be based in Sirte. One could ask, where else should they be based if they should monitor the implementation of the ceasefire? They have also agreed that the next meeting will take place already in Sirte, which is certainly the right move. So altogether, there is certainly some progress. But as far as it is known, they did not yet deal with the really hot issues, like the establishment of a really demilitarized zone and the extension of such zone, the stop of foreign training in Libya, let alone the withdrawal of foreign forces from Libya.
So how could a consensus in the military talks serve as a catalyst for the crucial political talks scheduled to be held in Tunisia on November 9th?
To be honest, I doubt that there will be a real consensus on major issues. As I've just outlined, there is some progress, and this is certainly a very positive, but there won't be a solution for the major issues in the near future. Furthermore, the group of 75 participating in the Libya Political Dialogue Forum in Tunis is entirely different. So I don't expect any direct impact from the 5+5 talks or group of 10 talks, as Stephanie Williams calls them now, for the Tunisia talks.
That was Wolfgang Paschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Migrants, organizations in South Africa have expressed shock and worry after members of the ruling African National Congress Veterans Association marched yesterday to demand foreign nationals in Durban leave. The vets forced them to close their shops and looted some. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The former freedom fighters brought shopping to a standstill at various shopping malls in Durban yesterday. They made it clear no foreign national should do any kind of trading in the city. They visited all foreign-owned shops and stalls in the central business district of Durban, forcing them to close shop and leave the country. Some shops were looted, forcing foreign nationals to lock themselves inside the shops, while some had to flee. Ngabutho Mabena, chairman of the Zimbabwe community in South Africa, says this is unacceptable and an embarrassment to the ruling ANC's accommodative spirit.
We are shocked that former members of MK are the ones that are doing against the presence of migrants in South Africa. We do not think that this is the manner to address these challenges. The White Paper on International Migration, as gazetted in 2017, is clear in terms of managing migration.
But one of the march organizers, who did not disclose his name, insists they now want their land, jobs and livelihoods back. He accused the ANC of ignoring their plea for action on foreign nationals who are squeezing locals out of livelihoods across the country.
Let us render the country ungovernable.
The latest threat by the former Liberation Fighters Wing has left foreign nationals scared that xenophobic violence could soon erupt. Amnesty International South Africa Director Shanila Mohammed has also condemned the latest trend of organized groups marching against foreign nationals.
We are definitely worried that this is now going to, break out into, again, the same type of xenophobic violence that we've seen over and over, 2008, last year, unfortunately, the difference between now and before is that it's becoming more organized.
The ANC has also condemned all acts of targeting foreign nationals. Lekwete Dakota is a member of the ANC's National Executive Committee.
It will be quite appalling and disturbing to find ourselves in a situation where we have to fight with our neighbors. What we can encourage is that governments in those countries must try their best to stabilize, ensure that they can feed and create jobs for their people, because we are also finding it difficult to carry our people and their people.
Last month, a group calling itself Put South Africa First marched to the Department of Home Affairs demanding that foreign nationals return to their countries. The government at the time said it will respond in due course after studying the memorandum of the anti-foreign nationals group. Repeated xenophobic violence in South Africa has left dozens of people dead and thousands displaced. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Ivory Coast's government is accusing opposition leaders of committing an act of sedition. According to a Reuters report, the government made the allegation after opposition leader Henry Konan Bedi and Pascal Affi N'Goussen announced a parallel administration in defiance of President Alassane Ouattara's recent landslide election victory. Bedi and N'Goussen argue that Ouattara's bid for a third term was unconstitutional. They had urged their supporters to boycott the election, and on Monday they announced the transitional council with Bedi as president. The Economic Community of West African States, the African Union, and the United Nations have urged the opposition to abandon the idea of a transitional council and engage in dialogue with the government. Violence in Ivory Coast after the 2010 election killed 3,000 people and sent thousands more fleeing into neighboring Ghana. 10 years later, many Ivorians, including those still living in Ghana, fear clashes leading up to Saturday's vote could trigger another round of unrest. Stacy Knott reports from Ampain refugee camp near the border with Ivory Coast.
Yves Glazebo was one of the 20,000 Ivorians who fled across the border after the 2010 election, after then-president Laurent Gbagbo refused to concede defeat to Alassane Ouattara. This year, President Ouattara is running for a controversial third term, prompting opposition parties to call for an election boycott and civil disobedience. Since 2011, Glazebo, not his real name, has lived at the Ampain refugee camp, close to the border with Ivory Coast, with about 3,000 other Ivorians. He, like many others in the camp, is watching the news come out of Ivory Coast in this election and is fearing for the worst.
Same election who bring war will be the same election who come just now at Cote d'Ivoire. We are looking, they're moving at TV. You see, Cote d'Ivoire, just now, peace no day at Cote d'Ivoire.
Already, there are Ivorians coming into Ghana trying to seek asylum. Madame Jete escaped the 2010-2011 election violence in which she says her family was targeted. She says those who are now entering Ghana feel the country is becoming dangerous.
When I talk, when I ask them, they are telling me that the situation in Cote d'Ivoire is getting worse. It getting killing is so much going on. So they have to find a way to leave Cote d'Ivoire to protect themselves.
Experts have also expressed concerns about the tension in Ivory Coast ahead of Saturday's election. Titi Paddy from the Ghana Refugee Board says a number of Ivorians have fled across the border and the board is in the process of registering them as refugees.
Well, we have noticed that a few people have indicated that they want to come into Ghana. But as you know, the borders have been closed due to the pandemic. And so we don't have that flow, at least not yet. We're not seeing large numbers coming in.
Back at the camp, father of five, Alan Yebe, says he wants to return home to Ivory Coast, but not until it's safe.
En fait, ça me fait 10 ans ici. Mon pays me manque.
I miss my country, he says. I lost my parents who were there. Since then, I haven't gone to Cote d'Ivoire. He says that actually, I don't know if my mother is still alive. So truly, I miss my country. He adds that if my country is free, I don't have any problem, I will go back. For now, those here will be watching what happens this weekend and praying history does not repeat itself. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Umpane Refugee Camp.
Free press activists say Zimbabwe's government is not living up to its claim of promoting media freedom or promises to ensure the security of journalists in the country. Reporter Kudzai Musenge brings us more from Harare.
Director Tabani Moyo is with the Zimbabwe chapter of the Media Institute of Southern Africa. He says despite promises by President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government to break with the past, attacks against journalists are increasing, especially in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Moyo made the comments on the sideline of an event to mark the International Day to End Impunity of Crimes Against Journalists, which was Monday. He says the day is important because it gives journalists and stakeholders time to examine their safety as they do their work. He says attacks not only hinder media freedom, but also impinge on other rights, as the media is paramount in informing society.
We have realized that journalists are literally in Zimbabwe reporting in the line of fire. Since the 1st of April, Zimbabwe witnessed an upsurge and recording of either journalists being harassed, beaten up, detained for purely doing their jobs, as opposed to the government's daily rhetoric that the craft is free in Zimbabwe. It is actually an endangered craft.
Among the journalists arrested or harassed this year is Opal Chingono, one of the country's best-known investigative journalists. He was arrested in July and held for 6 weeks after his reports outlined official corruption. On Tuesday evening, he was arrested again on charges of violating his bail conditions by making a social media post that referred to Zimbabwe's Chief Justice. Angela Quintal is the Africa Program Coordinator with the Committee to Protect Journalists. She says Zimbabwe has led the region in terms of violations against the press, particularly since the country began measures to contain the coronavirus pandemic. She said Mnangagwa's administration has failed to protect journalists or provide an environment for the news media to thrive and for citizens to have access to information.
It has been the organs of the state, especially the police, intelligence and military, who have been responsible for the assaults, abductions and arrests of journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists repeats its call for the authorities to reopen investigations into the 2007 abduction and murder of former ZBC cameraman Edward Chikomba. His killers must not escape justice.
Quintal said CPJ welcomes the repeal of the discredited Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act, or AIPA, and the enactment of new laws to replace it. However, she says more reforms are needed regarding laws that affect the media, including the Official Secrets Act and sections of the criminal law. Vivian Marara is with the Zimbabwe Association of Community Radio Stations, ZACRAS. Her organization welcomes the AIPA repeal, but hopes the new bills, two of which are still being drafted, do not introduce new problems.
What we just hope for is that the two remaining bills that are set to be enacted will not duplicate what was already in the Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act. As media stakeholders, our recommendations are that government should continue listening to stakeholder input, and where we do not agree, at least let's try as much as possible to make sure that we reach an amicable solution which enables us to promote media development in Zimbabwe.
Despite criticisms, the government maintains that it is doing well on upholding civil liberties, including media freedoms. Information Minister Monica Mutrangwa recently said the government remains open to dialogue with journalists and stakeholders on reforms. The International Day to End Impunity of Crimes Against Journalists was first observed on November 2, 2013, after the adoption of a UN resolution. Reporting for VOA, this is Kudzanai Msengi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.